Hey everyone, welcome to the Grief Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Garcia, and this is a place where I bring you authentic conversations with people who are willing to share their journey through seasons of grief. No matter your cultural upbringing, societal conditioning, or faith practice, grief affects us all. Whether you're dealing with a loss, a diagnosis, a broken heart, or the everyday stressors of life, or love someone who is, these conversations are here to support you in that process. So be sure to check out the show notes for potential trigger warnings. And whether you're very comfortable with or deeply avoidant of grief and its many responses, you are welcome here. Thank you for being here, and now on to the episode. Hey everybody, thank you for joining the Grief Informed Podcast. I'm grateful that you're here again. And today I have with me the amazing Dewey Freeman. I want to tell you a little bit about him. Dewey is a highly sought-after teacher, trainer, licensed therapist, and equine professional. He has taught worldwide and developed a practical attachment theory and human development theory taught to thousands of university students. He has nearly 8,000 direct client hours and co-founded the Gestalt Equine Institute and the Gestalt Institute of the Rockies. He supervises therapists and graduate students and does business and land consultations for new equine therapy sites. He embodies both tenderness and strength in all of his relations and work. His quality of contact and relationship with others is authentic and unique. People come from around the world to study with him. Dewey is a true elder and mentor, exploring new horizons and facilitating men's growth work. Gestalt and relational horsemanship are not just approaches to Dewey. They are how he walks through the world. Wow. Welcome, Dewey.
Well,
I'm not trying to be funny, but you're kind of a big deal.
Well, I don't know that I would go so far as to say that.
I will. And everyone who I've heard of you from, the Travers and the Leelas, and they cannot speak highly of you enough. And even the first time I actually got to hear you talk was last month on a elders call through Man and Civilized,
right,
that you did when y'all opened it up to the women.
Yeah, the live one that we did.
Yes. Yeah. I was there.
That was an amazing call. That was very
cool. It was powerful. I loved it. And that's when I was like, ooh, I wonder if he would come on my podcast. So
the answer is definitely yes.
Yes, I'm glad you're here. Okay, so could you tell us a little bit about your cultural upbringing and background?
This will actually fit into the rest of what we talk about. I grew up in Northeast Ohio. And when my mother was pregnant with me, she had tuberculosis. She was diagnosed with tuberculosis. Mm. And my mother and father had a little girl, my older sister, who was a year old. And if you can imagine, in 1949 is when she was diagnosed with TB. And if you could imagine how upsetting that was to my family. And that actually started a whole process to where when I was born, my mother was whisked away to the sanitarium and I stayed with my grandparents mostly. But when my mother was healthy enough to be able to come home and then bring me home, that was actually close to 18 months old when that happened. We, meaning my family, moved out to a place outside of Akron, Ohio that was Amish country. So if I were to look at cultural and background from that perspective, a huge portion of my family is either Amish or Mennonite. So I grew up in that area. And interestingly enough, my father is Catholic. So there was this whole mixture of culture and religion and background, which was primarily Pennsylvania Dutch and German. So all of that got mixed up together. And but that's the community that I grew up in, with cousins who were either Amish or Mennonite. And we were in that community and part of that community, but almost lived on the fringe of it culturally. So all of that was mixed together. And I would, this last week, I was at a week-long horsemanship clinic where I was a participant. And we were sitting around the table. There were people from all over the U.S. there. And they were talking about all the culture, I mean, all the music concerts they went to. And they asked me, did you go to concerts growing up? And it was like, no, we didn't have radios. We didn't have a TV. Wow. So I'm sort of a bit of, I'm not quite sure exactly how I would describe myself culturally other than that, in that we were pretty isolated. The place that I found solace was outside and with the horses in the community. I'm not sure how to describe myself any better than that from a cultural standpoint, because there isn't, even though my parents and grandparents on one side were from Germany, my grandparents on the other side had background from England. But I don't feel like any of that really fit in more than the Amish and Pennsylvania Dutch. So
That's good info. No concerts, though. What was the first concert you ever went to?
I went to one Grateful Dead concert.
Of course. Oh, shout out to my friend Jenny. She's going to love that.
Yeah. And I've only been to like two or three concerts in my life. So I'm not, it's an interesting thing. On one level, I like music. On another level, it's certainly not the first place I go for.
Yeah.
Entertainment or solace or anything like that. So
solace at a concert? Well, that's not possible.
Well, I'm talking about even music in general. I don't listen.
So you don't listen to music a lot? No, just on your own.
No, it just was never part of my growing up. I don't have any background in it. So
interesting.
It took me. I grew up and I was probably, I think maybe in eighth or grade or something like that when the Beatles came to the U.S. and I was going, who are they? So
wow.
So that's sort of the it's just a part of my life. It's not been a big part of my life.
Right. When you said you were kind of isolated.
We were very isolated. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So do you know your Enneagram number? Which this is a surprise to me, but I want you to know I've written it down in a corner on a piece of paper because I think I want to guess, but I want you to tell me.
Well, I don't know for sure.
Okay.
It's not something that I've studied a lot. Uh-huh. I mean, I know what people are talking about when they're talking about it. Most people that know me who have studied it have said I'm an 8. One person insisted I was a 6, but when I look at it, 8 probably seems to fit the best.
Interesting. That is not one of the numbers that I had on mine. Okay.
Well, I don't know.
When you've heard about the 8, what feels like that resonates with an 8?
I don't know that much about it. I don't know enough about it to know. So
8s are like they're like the ones that are revolutionaries. They've got the drive and the desire to like change the world, but through a justice filter, like right and wrong, this is what you do, but there's an intensity that they carry. Like Traver being an 8, and who else was an 8? Dave Boyd that I interviewed was an 8. Anyway, I see all the books behind you and your love of knowledge, and I just had a different number that I thought you might be.
Oh, what would you say?
I thought you might be a 5. And everybody who loves Enneagram would get on to me because you're not supposed to try to type someone. So you're not hearing me do that, but I just. The lover of knowledge, but the fives are probably the most knowledgeable ones in a room on so many subjects, but they don't just freely offer that information unless they're invited to. So it's like, that's why I wondered.
Well, actually both of those sort of fit a little bit. I don't know if you can be split between two.
You can't, but you can go to another number in strength and another number in stress.
Got it.
So
the, yeah. I could see both Dave and Traver being eights or revolutionary. Yes. My life has been actually that.
Yeah.
And but my process of doing that, I think, is probably more quiet than theirs.
Mm-hmm. Introspective. And, yeah.
But it's like, for instance, one of my, in my, last part of my life and career, part of what I want to be able to do is change how therapy is done in the world. And part of my perspective is therapeutically, we have begun to be run by insurance companies and behaviorism instead of relational process, that everything's a protocol and you do this and you do this and you do this. And that's not what I think happens. That's not what heals people from or helps people grow. I mean, even with the developmental theory that I put together and the attachment theory, it goes against everything that everybody says out there. So, and the reason I started the Gestalt Equine Institute of the Rockies, because I'd run the Gestalt Institute of the Rockies for years, was because what I tend to do is I'll go, oh, this is a good idea to do something here. And then I'll go learn and I'll go, this isn't good enough. This doesn't go deep enough into something. We need to dive into this in a different way. So from that point, I don't necessarily go, I'm going to go up against somebody.
Yeah.
What I tend to do is just go, well, that's not working. So let's put something together that works.
Okay, so you've devoted your life's work to attachment theory. And my question to start this off with is, why would that be important for any of us lay people out here not in in the world of therapy? Why would it be important for us to know what that theory is and what attachment is?
Well, let me define attachment first, just generally. First of all, let me give an overview. We can attach at any point in time in our lives. And when we enter into relationships and those relationships over time deepen into a deep intimacy, that's a level of attachment. What I would call our initial attachment, which actually begins in utero, deepens through our birthing process and then deepens through the first 18 months to 2 years of life, is that attachment, that deep instinctual trust-based bond that we form that gets formed between infants and parents, and hopefully both parents, that forms the blueprint of how we do relationships the rest of our lives. That initial, and I do think attachment starts in utero. I don't know if it starts immediately upon conception. I don't know enough to know that. But through that process, that first 9 months and then the next 18 to 24 months, so that whole process takes somewhere between, 30 to 36 months to happen. But that when that happens in a healthy way, it creates a healthy blueprint that goes into every relationship in our life. And also goes into how we interpret those relationships, what expectations we have out of those relationships, and how we perceive information coming from all of those relationships. It also drives how we grieve. When we have what I would call fragmented attachment, what happens in that process, we end up with what I would call a fragmented blueprint for which we lead our lives. And we also, when we have that fragmented process going on, we do relationships in a fragmented way. We end up interpreting relationships in a fragmented way. We have expectations in a fragmented way. So we never really get to fully enter into a relationship because we, sort of the way I look at it is, if you could think, you know, the big puzzles that you have that are 500 or 1,000 pieces and you put out on your kitchen table and put them together.
Right.
Sort of the fragmented process that I would just metaphorically would be one of those puzzles that are sort of halfway together with all kinds of missing pieces. So that then that's how we go into relationships, is we go into relationships with missing pieces from the inside out. And the way that I look at that, and I'll just bring in another piece here, because we're talking about sort of the, quote, rebellion piece. And this might fit right into the five, if whatever, however that works, is when Bowlby and Ainsworth started talking about secure versus insecure attachment, then the insecure attachment is broken into avoidant, anxious, and disorganized. I've never seen anybody with what might be called insecure attachment that just isn't one of those boxes. Nobody is just only avoidant. Nobody is just only anxious. Nobody is just only anxious, disorganized. They get all mixed up. So I'm not sure that I don't see that as a very helpful model, because we don't know what it is. When we look at, if we can look at, because nobody stays in whatever box or silo that they're assigned.
Right.
And particularly nobody stays in those boxes when they're in the middle of loss or grief. And somebody might come in and go, so how do you know about what happens when you're fragmented? Well, what happens when we're fragmented, it's different for everybody. So part of the process in both therapeutic work, but also growth work, is to find those places where we have the left out pieces, or what I would call an impasse. And every person, I believe, has a different impasse or a different set of impasses.
Yeah.
And the reason I call them impasses is because it's something that I believe very strongly that we can get through. It isn't something that we just go, okay, well, there's an impasse, I can't do that. It's more like, okay, there's an impasse, what do I need to do to work through that?
I love that. So you came up with five. You call them...
The five
stages of that attachment. From starting zero to two, and what were those five?
Well, I don't think there's five stages of that. There are four sets of messages that we get during that.
Okay. But
the stage, and this is where people sort of misunderstand what I talk about from a developmental place. There are five stages that I talk about from birth through actually conception, then birth through early adulthood. Mm-hmm. And the attachment stage that we just spoke about is the stage people are trying to find out if the world's an okay place to be. Mm-hmm. That's what they're trying to find out. And they're trying to find out primarily, am I safe and where do I belong? Those are the two main things they're trying to find out. When we go into around two-ish, between two and two and a half, we enter into another stage, and that stage is what I call, am I okay? Mm-hmm. So the first stage is the world okay? The second stage is, am I okay? And that stage is usually between about two and four-ish. The next stage starts again. These overlap around three and a half to six-ish, which is what I call, how much can I do? Mm-hmm. And if you watch a 5 or 6 year old, they'll dump and fill the same pot or pan or truck or something in the sandbox all day long. They'll just go back and forth because they're trying to sort of embed what a process and trying to put together, literally finding out how much they can do.
Yeah.
And then the next stage is how well can I do it? And that stage is between about 6.5 to, or 7 to up to about 10 or 11. And that stage is about quality versus quantity. Mm-hmm. And then the next stage, which is what we typically call adolescence, is who am I? Mm-hmm. And it's in adolescence where we begin trying to put together a value system. Adolescence is primarily about putting together a value system instead of a belief system. And the reason I say that is because up until adolescence, and we don't have, we believe what people told us. And we get messages, and we get messages in 4 primary ways early on in our life, but we get messages that we believe because we trust our parents or we don't trust our parents, but we believe that we're not trustworthy. I mean, those are the kind of messages that can happen. Mm-hmm. But in adolescence, our process is sort of to regurgitate those messages sort of out in front of us and pick what we value, take in what we value and discard the rest. And so when we do that, we begin to put together a value system. And then I'll just add one more on, which is early adulthood, is who am I really? Because many of us at 17 or 18 think we really do know everything.
Right.
And we have it all together. And then about 24 or 25, we go, well, we probably didn't really know everything. So now you have to go back and do it again.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And sometimes I'll call that first adulthood stage, who am I in relationship?
Yeah.
So real quickly, just for people listening, the 4 ways we get messages are spoken, unspoken, secret, and somatic. I'll just go through those real quick. Spoken is people say that. It's like, this is what I want you to do. Here's the message. The unspoken is, people don't say it, but if you ask what the message is, you'll get told. They'll tell you. The secret messages are those messages that we don't know unless we get in trouble. And then even when we get in trouble, whomever is giving those messages, they don't usually tell you. So it leaves us pretty lost. And then the 4th one is the somatic messages. And the somatic messages happen a lot in utero through our birthing process in that first couple of years of life. And many times those things go together. So let me give you a quick example. Where I grew up, the message was everybody's equal. We're not supposed to be prejudiced, et cetera, et cetera. That was the spoken message. The unspoken message was, well, you might not want to date a black girl because, you know, it just might not be, it'd just be difficult because of societal stuff. The secret message was, if you date a black girl, we're going to disown you. Which actually happened because I dated a black girl. I didn't know that secret message until I ended up dating a girl who was black. So many times we'll get layers of messages.
And how is this information of attachment and understanding? Okay, we can go back and we can look at all those stages, 0 to 2, all the way to adolescence and beyond. How is that going to help us learn how to grieve or what to grieve that might be coming up for us?
When you look at all of the research and all of the attachment theories out there, they essentially boil down to, Can we go through a tough time in contact, in relationship with another person or another being and come out okay? And is that predictable, consistent, and predictable? That's the core of all attachment, whether it be between you and I, if we got things messed up when we were looking for the time or something like that. Can you go through that in contact and relationship and come out okay? That's just a minor thing.
Right.
Or in an adult relationship, can you with a partner go through a really hard time and come out okay? And that needs to be consistent and predictable. So let me walk through what happens in utero and real quick, and then what happens in that first couple of years of life. In utero, we're always looking for food, or we're always getting food through the umbilical cord. We're always being touched, and we're always being moved. We're being touched by, you know, because we're held in our mother's womb, and then mom is always either walking or breathing or rolling over or sitting up or sitting down, whatever she's doing in her life. When we go through our birthing process, that's the first time that we go through a really hard time and come out okay. Hopefully, when things go well. When that happens, and then we get laid, hopefully, in the ideal situation on our mother's chest and or our father's chest, that's the where, again, we're looking for food, we're looking for touch, and we're looking for movement. And as and hopefully that begins immediately upon being born. Shortly after our birth, we will need food, touch, and movement. And food, touch, and movement, just this is a little aside, food later in life turns into being nurtured. Also, we feel that in infancy. Touch is contact, and movement is the process of, it gets expanded into movement of energy through our body, which I call emotion. So when we have energy moving through our body and we have that as a sense of what is happening, we call that an emotion. And we, you can see that in people. When people get angry, you can see the energy come up. When people are depressed, you can see the energy go down, for instance. As an infant, we bid for food, touch, and movement by being cute, by wiggling, by smiling, by crying, by slobbering all over, by all of those fun things. When that happens and our parent attends to us, they pick us up, they check our diapers, they clean us up, they rock us. And here's the key. They give us that food, touch, and movement in contact and relationship. When that happens, when that process happens, we feel like the world's an okay place to be, and we begin to trust. And then we want food, touch, and movement. We go through that whole cycle many times. In the early 90s, I did a study. Infants and toddlers go through that cycle between 10 and 15 times an hour.
Wow.
And it can be as little as an infant beginning to just cry and sort of go, huh, huh, huh. And you reach over and you touch them and rock them gently, and they go, huh, huh. That's a whole cycle. Or somebody can, like an infant, not fully an infant, but infant, later on, when they start teething, that cycle may take 4 hours because they're going through such a rough time. Mm-hmm. Or if they have colic or their little tummy's upset. But the key is going through that hard time in contact and relationship. If we get fed and our diapers changed and even rocked it's not in contact and relationship. Like, for instance, if a parent is holding their baby, but they're on the phone or they're watching TV or there's a whole bunch of other children running around, what happens is that we're not making contact when our babies are getting food, touch, and movement. So instead of attaching to the person providing the food, touch, and movement, they're attaching to the food, touch, and movement itself, which is actually that's the foundation for addictions, is the attachment to. And that's what an addiction is, from my perspective, is we're attached to food, or we're attached to touch, or we're attached to movement, instead of attaching to the person providing the food, providing the touch, or providing the movement. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah.
So, but all of that sets the underlying foundation for how we do relationships. It also sets the underlying foundation for how we grieve. So let me talk about that real quick, and then I'll walk through another piece if that would be helpful.
Okay.
Healthy attachment is our foundation and our protection from trauma and from major loss. It doesn't mean that if we have healthy attachment that we'll never experience trauma, nor does it mean that if we have healthy attachment we'll never experience loss. We will. We'll probably experience both of those things in our lives. But if we have healthy attachment when we experience trauma or we experience loss, essentially, and this is a very quick and dirty way to say it, but what we end up feeling is that, again, this is with healthy attachment, we end up feeling like the world's an okay place to be and bad things happen. And that's how really strong healthy attachment protects us. If we don't have really strong healthy attachment, if we have that fragmented attachment, we experience trauma and or loss or major stress in our lives, we go back and we go, the world's not okay. The world's not okay. The world's not okay. I don't know if I'll ever make it through this. Bad things happen and the world's bad. I mean, those are the kinds of internal messages we have. And that makes a huge difference in our grieving process.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to you?
Yes. Yes.
So in 2011, I have two younger brothers. My youngest brother died of cancer. Mm-hmm. And it's like, his name is John. And it was horrible that he died. And it's horrible not having him around. Mm-hmm. And the world's still an okay place to be. Mm-hmm. So it isn't that I go, I don't feel anything. I feel a huge amount. I mean, and he lived in Florida, and I went down to Florida and helped him and his wife and stayed with them for a while and helped bring him home from the hospital to home hospice. And I mean, that whole process, but it's still, the world's an okay place to be. And this horrible thing is happening. Versus I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know whether I'll be able to make it through this, all of those kind of things. So in the grieving process that I see is, and I'll just use this as an example, is like, is my world okay without John in it? Am I okay without John in my world? How much can I do without John as part of my world? How well can I do it? And who am I without John in my world? And so there is a huge grieving process in there, but at the same time, I'm grieving the loss of my brother. I'm not grieving the loss of being okay in the world. And those are very different things.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, one is devastating to, the way I would put it is, grieving the loss of my brother is devastating to my heart and my soul. If I don't have strong attachment, then it's devastating to my entire being.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Oh, it's it makes me think of an example of why I know there's fragmented attachment for me because of trauma, early childhood trauma. But if I would love to give an example people, and you can tell me where this falls in. But the one that sticks out the most in parenting was I have four teenagers, and when my first one learned to drive, I wanted to be the mom that, I love adventure. I love the freedom of being able to have your first car and the windows down and music blaring and you just enjoying the freedom. And I wanted to be able to hand over those keys and say, yes, let's do this. And when he first started driving, that was how I felt. But part of my story is my dad, I had lost my mom when she was 10 to lupus, but my dad was killed in a car accident when I just turned 20 and was left with that. Yeah, my world was not. There was a lot of chaos in there for me. But there was this moment when my son, he had been driving for like 6 months, but he came home and said, I want to go. Our school made it to the, you know, state playoffs an hour and a half away. On this day, we're all allowed to pass. Me and my brother go, who was a year younger than him, who is a year younger than him. And it was a just stop moment. Like my nervous system, it was the night before he was supposed to go. I'd put it off so long. And then finally he's like, Mom, if I'm going to do it, I got to go. And everything in my body, I just said, well, you know, I just don't think, honestly, I mean, I hate this. I know this sounds terrible. I don't feel ready for this. He's like, Mom, you know, I can do this. I've got this. I'm careful. Telling me all the logical reasons. But what was happening in my brain, okay, because my body was, I was on just full activation, trying to remain calm. This should be an exciting situation. Everything in me was wanting to say, but if I let you get in that car, you will die. You could die. Mm-hmm. I've seen it happen. I'm envisioning walking into that hospital room that I had to do the whole experience with my dad. Like I describe it as like, it's like a projector screen that mm-hmm. I'm looking at my son, but there's this very real projection playing over him. And it's so hard in that moment to separate. But because of the doing this work and the skill and graciousness of my son at the time, it said, paused. And I just kept giving logic. And I wasn't expressing the full what was in my brain, but he could see it. And he said, Mom, I kind of feel like this might be you are scared because of what happened to your dad. And if it makes you feel any better, I could have Alex text you like every 15 minutes as we drive down the road, like making light and made me giggle. And I was like, oh my goodness. And it just broke that projection of like, okay, this is a natural process. And I could see he's right. This is about my dad. And then I could separate later and be like, oh my goodness, I need to feel how scary this feels. The grief of I lost my dad in a very tragic car accident, but that's not what's happening right now. And so that, like, I feel like what you're talking about, it's like mixing grief, or it feels like there's a very real grief, but then there's this part that just feels very old. That comes up at different times. I mean, that's one scenario of many in relationship where you're navigating, where I feel like I'm having to navigate that sense of that projection onto an experience.
Well, you're 100% accurate. And so part of what happens is exactly what you just said, is that our interactions in the present are not clean. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that in any negative way. It's just that we're not dealing with what's right in front of us.
Right.
And we're dealing with what's in front of us plus whatever else is unfinished. And a lot of times we don't even know what that is. Like, actually what I'll say is you have a pretty sharp son.
I do.
I give you credit for that, because the fact that he was able to sense that and say it to you also has a lot to do with what you've done with him.
Thank you.
So kudos to you and kudos to him. And so it's like one of the pieces around grief and around loss is that I work toward, and I try to help other people work toward, is to be able to grieve specifically what we've lost right now versus grieving what we've lost now and then what we lost 7 days ago and what we lost 7 years ago. And it doesn't mean that stuff doesn't come up. I mean, just like when I was speaking about my brother. It's like, I will have feelings. I will be affected by bringing up my brother and that story. But it's like, it's right in the moment. I don't walk around every day and go, you know, I wish I didn't lose my brother. I wish I didn't lose my brother. It's more like, that happened. And, you know, it's interesting. I was looking for some stuff because I'm in the middle of writing a bunch of things, and I found the write-up I did for his services, and I read that yesterday, and I hadn't read it for probably 10 or 12 years. And,
wow.
And it was like, oh, this is pretty amazing. And it affects my heart, but it doesn't rock my world. If that makes sense.
No, it does. But you're seeing, like, that's the part of grief that I want people to understand is it's not just, like you said, walking around constantly sad that you're missing someone. It's moments of interaction in relationship to your world where something comes up and you may not even recognize that what you're facing is older than that moment right in front of you.
Yes, exactly. So one of the pieces to tie this together a little bit is if we're in the middle of grief or grieving something and we're really going like, my world sucks, I can't do this, I can't even move, all of those things, that's an indication that something else is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I really want to emphasize that when I say that, I'm not saying that with any level of judgment. I'm not saying, and I don't want anybody who listens to this to go, oh, well, that means I'm really messed up. No, it doesn't mean you're really messed up. All it means is that there's something that you haven't finished up. That's all it means. And there's not a judgment with it. There's not a good or a bad with it. There's even not a good or a bad with all the attachment stuff. Because we didn't have anything to do with that. It wasn't my choice that my mother had tuberculosis.
Right.
It wasn't my choice that when, you know, I was 18 months old when I moved back in, and my mother basically said I was like a neighborhood kid moving in. I didn't have anything to do with that.
Yeah.
I mean, other than my experience of it, but it wasn't that I caused that. There's a lot that we can do to work with that. And so since we really are talking about grief, this is a really big piece, I think. If anyone's listening to that, what I'm hoping they're saying is, okay, so I get what you're saying. What do I do about that attachment piece?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the biggest, and this fits right into what we're talking about on this podcast, is that when we have issues around attachment that we have to work with, the primary piece that we need to do is allow ourselves to grieve the loss of our parents and the loss of that attachment with our parents. And there's a whole piece in here that sometimes we're actually grieving the loss of what we know as what our parents could have been and are typically should have been. Because we have, I believe, like an instinctual knowing of the archetype of a healthy mother and archetype of a healthy father. And we know that. And we don't know as little kids what it is. We just know that something's missing.
Right.
And, or that something needs a shift, or it's like, why isn't this happening? We understand that piece, but we haven't put together that we actually really know what a mother is.
Yeah.
From an archetypal perspective, or what a father is from an archetypal perspective. Sometimes we are actually grieving the loss of a parent or both parents.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes we're grieving, many parents come in and they really do the very best they can do. And because of their wounding, even they may not be able to do what really needs to be done. So it's not only grieving of that loss of our parents, but it's the grieving of the archetypal mother and the archetypal father.
Yeah.
And how affects us and what we know that to be.
Yeah. And do you find that a lot of people, because from my experience, it was, you know, there's this after death, I think there, in my, for me, there was this definite idealization. I can remember when being in high school, I don't think I talked about the loss of my mom very much, but I remember getting passionate when my friends would complain about normal everyday occurrences with their moms as teenagers. And me, mm-hmm. I would be uphill like, oh, if, you know, gosh, if my mom was here, like I just would want to be so close, and really wasn't compassionate for my friends of what reality is. Cause now I have mm-hmm. a teen daughter and I'm like, wait, they do that? Cause I never had those experiences with my mom. And now I'm like, oh, this is totally in the range of normal. Yes. But at the time, it was like this idealization, like, oh, I would never argue with my mom if she were alive. And then when my dad died, it was the same thing. It wasn't until I had kids that I faced that. What were they really like? And could, when I started noticing patterns in myself that were like inhibiting contact and connection in my relationships, I was getting in therapy, going to back to, okay, well, what did you learn about these strategies, or where did you learn them? And it was coping through things that I just didn't know how to process when I was a kid, that then coming mm-hmm. into adulthood could look back and go, oh, that's why I felt abandonment from my father, because my mother had died and he became an alcoholic and he wasn't able to be present at my games mm-hmm. or my things. And, oh, wow, that really did affect me. And it was almost like this, aha. But it took a willingness to face that I think took me a long time for my nervous system to be ready to do that. Do you find that works that way for most people?
Yeah, yeah. And so do I have your permission to even speak about what you just spoke around?
Absolutely.
Attachment and relationship to your mother and your father?
Absolutely.
So here's what I would postulate, and I would have to know more to really be able to go definitively, this is it. So I'm just putting this out as a postulation to allow people maybe to think about this in a little bit different way. I think you said your mother died when you were 10, is that what mm-hmm. you said?
Yeah.
And your father died when you were 20?
Yes.
So one, it's sort of interesting that it's 10 years apart. It's 10 years and then 10 years. Mm-hmm. But here would be my postulation if I were looking at this with you. There's probably a very good chance that your father was pretty attached to your mother.
Oh, yeah. Never dated again after she died. That was it.
And there's also a very good chance that he did not have a really strong original attachment.
That is true.
Because when the attachment between him and your mother disappeared, what he did was become attached to alcohol instead mm-hmm. of being able to go, here's this woman that I love dearly. Here's this woman that is the mother of my children. And it was as horrible as it could be that I lost my wife and I lost my partner and I lost the mother of my children, and the world's still an okay place to be. This is a horrible thing that has happened, and the world's okay.
Right.
So where his attachment went was to alcohol, because he didn't have that underlying protection of that really solid foundational attachment. And it breaks my heart to know that.
Yeah.
But if we can look at it that way, both from a standpoint of how, if we're in a situation like you've been in, that could, at least in my world, that would give me a tremendous amount of compassion toward both my mother and my father, mm-hmm. which is actually what I had to do with my mother and my father. Because my father had PTSD from World War II, and my mother lived to 83 years old, so good mm-hmm. on her. And it wasn't until I was 34 and going through all kinds of stuff that I finally asked my mother, what was it like for you mm-hmm. to have a child that you could not hold, that you could not be around, that you could not snuggle up to. And that actually is what changed my relationship with my mother way to the better, because I actually got what she went through. And I mean, I remember where I was sitting. I remember us, what we were talking about. I remember. And when I asked that, we both just started sobbing. And because she went through as much loss as I went through, and then probably more. So being able to have an understanding of what's gone on actually helps us create a tremendous amount of compassion for people in our lives that have struggled and have not maybe gotten even as good of attachment as we've gotten.
Yeah. So when you, as your work as a therapist, and I'm imagining couples, okay, partnership, marriages, when you're doing like the level of compassion that it would take to not just know the background of your person, but like to be able to get to the depths of what they experienced through these stages, what are some of the things that you see commonly come up in relationship, let's say in that, in relationship to partnerships, where your theory has just cracked open at an impasse and made a way?
I think I know what you're asking. Why don't you ask in a little bit different way?
Like when you're dealing with couples, okay, so this work, and then there's, I mean, there's the grief aspect, but let's say you've got a couple sitting and they're at an impasse sitting with you, and you're able to pinpoint where they might be stuck in the...
Got it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Kimberly, my partner, and I, we work together. We also live together. So we're partners in pretty much every sense of the word.
Yeah.
And she's also a therapist. Very good, by the way. We're working with a couple who came in. We do couples intensives where couples come in for 2 days. And the couple came in, and about a year ago, the wife discovered that the husband had a series of affairs throughout their relationship. Actually, 8. And like anybody would, she was furious. Would be. And so they had done some stuff therapeutically and they were working through it. But when they came in, and we'd done a thing on Zoom with them, but they came in from out of state. And one of the things I began asking the man is, tell me about what happened in utero, and tell me about what happened in your birthing process, and tell me what happened in your first few years of life. And just thinking about it, he broke down and started sobbing. And there was huge amounts of loss in the early part of his life. And I don't want to go in too deeply into it because I want to protect his confidentiality. But it was like no contact, severe illness of both that he had and his mother had. And it was like we went through a whole process of and took most of the first day to work through a huge amount of stuff. And at the end of that, he was actually able to begin saying, and we started putting together that what he was seeking in all of those affairs was what he didn't get as an infant. And by the end of the second day, he was able to go, what he said, the commitment and the grief that he had about what he caused in their relationship, and the way he was able to put it together between him and his wife was amazing. And his wife was able to go, oh, this wasn't because I wasn't good enough. This wasn't because I wasn't sexy enough. This wasn't because I wasn't kind enough. This wasn't because of any of those things. This was because you had so much stuff unfinished that you couldn't be with me. And so that was a whole piece that we were able to work through. I think that was another piece.
Yeah. So
let me share one other story, because it's not just, and this is another true story. This was like probably 14 or 15 years ago. A family came in from out of state. It was a mother, father, and a 13-year-old boy. And the 13-year-old boy literally hated his mother. And I've never seen a 13-year-old boy or any 13-year-old boy or girl have the level of hatred that this kid had toward his mom. Hmm. And they'd been in therapy after therapy after therapy. And as I would, and I started working with them and asking about early stuff and really early stuff. Well, it took a day and a half to get to this. And they were here for 4 days. And when this little guy was under 6 weeks old, he had been in and out of the hospital 3 times for failure to thrive. Mm. What actually was happening was that he was allergic to his mother's breast milk.
Wow.
And so literally every time his mother would try to feed and nurture and hold him, he felt like she wanted to kill him. Mm. And that's almost what happened. He almost died 2 or 3 times.
Wow.
Because of that level of immune system reaction. And the doctors kept saying, no, breastfeeding, breastfeeding, breastfeeding. And so she followed that advice until she finally went, this isn't working. And she began to give him whatever kind of formula she did. And he began to thrive. But therapeutically, nobody had ever looked at that. And it took a long time to figure that out. That was not an easy puzzle.
Did he have memory of that?
No, he didn't have memory of it. But what he did was after we got through it, by about the end of the 3rd day or beginning of the 4th day, he actually went, he had a somatic memory of, Mom, you tried to kill me.
Mm.
And what he finally got was all of that got integrated and woven together to the point of when they left, it was like they had a whole new foundation of which to start from. And he was able to go, I get it, Mom, that now you weren't trying to kill me. And that's why I hated you, because you tried to kill me. And the mother was just devastated when she would hear the first part, because she wasn't. I mean, they were actually really pretty decent parents.
Right.
And what's really cool now is he's halfway through his master's degree to become a therapist.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And has a really pretty decent relationship with his folks. But when he was had such hatred toward his mom, the father would come at her physically. He would yell and scream. I mean, he was an incredibly bright kid, so he very verbal. So his father ended up having to protect the mom. So then it ruined his relationship with his father too. So, but it was going back and figuring that out that changed it enough. And then they actually came out a couple of other times, and we worked through that. Mm. But now they're doing great. Every once in a while, I hear from him about how well he's doing, and he graduated with a bachelor's degree in sociology and psychology or something like that, and now he's halfway through a master's degree in counseling.
That's powerful, because he was able to go back and track. So for everybody listening, what's the steps that you take to, what are you going to notice in your world that you're like, maybe I should look into this and look into going back and processing what happened in early childhood?
When I hear language of things like, I don't trust anybody, you can only trust yourself, you can't depend on anybody, nothing will ever work out okay. The universe is after me. You can only trust certain people. That, I mean, it was interesting at the first part of the podcast that you asked about culture, because that's one of the things. It's like you can only trust people from this culture, whatever culture that is that somebody's in. You can only trust certain people who believe certain things. You know, there, it's a, people live in a very, very, very small world. Behaviorally, people get into a place of having very few friends or no friends at all, because you can't trust anybody. Spiritually, people get very narrow in their spiritual beliefs. And one of the biggest things, whether it's culturally, behaviorally, religiously, or spiritually, or even somatically, people get into that there's only one right way. Everything is black and white. It's either this or nothing else. I mean, all of those kinds of things.
Dogma. I hear a lot of dogma.
Yeah. And I want to say, and it's dogma around everything. And I want to say very clearly, I'm not talking about any particular spiritual belief. I'm not talking about any particular religion, because it doesn't matter.
Right.
I mean, somebody can be in any particular spiritual belief or any particular religion and be very open and accepting, or somebody can be in a very dogmatic state. So I'm not talking about any specific one. I want to make that very clear.
Right. Yeah.
When I hear someone say things like, I don't trust anybody, I only trust myself, or I'm trustworthy, but nobody else is, I get really worried.
Yeah. And you mentioned also there's a scarcity piece, which comes up huge for me. Is the world safe? Like, that's that.
Yeah.
Is there more? Will there be more? Yeah.
Yeah, or things like, is the world safe? I don't belong anyplace. I'm just waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Yeah.
I know bad things are going to happen. I know that, you know, yeah, I love my partner, but I know they're going to cheat on me. Or I love so-and-so, but you can't really fully trust somebody. I mean, those kind of things.
Yeah.
We live on the side of a mountain and west of Golden, and there's like four or five neighbors around here that we call any time of the day or night. And if I need help, the same way with Traver and Dave Boyd and all the men uncivilized people, it's like I could call them anytime.
Yeah.
And before the phone was hung up, they would have their keys and be heading up here. So if I needed, even if I was out of town, then I would fully trust them with everything. So it's the opposite of that. It's like I have nobody to call. I have nobody to speak to. I have nobody to, like, yeah, I got to do it all myself. All of those kind of things.
Yeah. And so they recognize they have this patterning. What's next?
If it, you mean in trying to help them, or
yeah, if they're like, okay, I'm curious. I'm noticing I say those things. Now what do I need to do?
That's only one of the biggest questions you could ever ask. So
right at the end, like, you know, just go
right at the end. So we'll be here till midnight.
Okay. Fair enough.
Actually, no. It's a great question. So the first thing that somebody, when somebody says, oh my God, I'd listened to this podcast, or I've heard this from someplace else, what do I need to do? The very first thing that somebody needs to do is find someone to talk to. Mm. So let me say this piece, and this will be a bit of a guideline.
Okay.
Our deepest wounding in our lives come from something happening in a relationship. That's our deepest wounding. That might be a parent dying. That might be a child dying. That might be a parent being sick, like my mother was sick. It might be being in a relationship where we think we can trust a person, but then, then that person assaults us in some way. It might be any of those kind of things. So all of the major woundings come from being in a relationship. We get wounded in relationship.
Yeah.
The only way out of that is to be in relationship. It's the only way out. Even if that begins with a small group of people sharing what's going on in their lives, even if it begins with being able to say to somebody, like, for instance, somebody knows you, them saying to you, can I sit down and talk to you? Or I want to share that this is what happened to me. Those kind of things. That, because we need to express and we need to be heard in that expression.
Yeah.
So being seen, heard, gotten, cherished, and protected.
Yeah.
And sometimes that needs to go into a therapeutic relationship. Sometimes it can be sitting on a park bench talking to a very good friend.
Yeah.
Last week, I mentioned that I was at a horsemanship clinic all week while I was a student, and we rode twice a day, which was incredible. So I spent about 20 hours on my horse over 5 days. But the group that I was with, we got really close. And one of the women in the group, there were two men and there were probably 10, 11 women, something like that.
Yeah.
And this woman was from out of state, out of Colorado. And we were just chit-chatting and she said, I sat next to you on purpose, Dewey. And I said, really? She said, because I felt a calmness in you. And I felt that you were safe to sit next to. And so we started chatting, and we would chat for 10 or 15 minutes, like while we were walking out to the horses or on a break or something. At one point, we were just talking about attachment. And she goes, can I share something with you? And I said, yeah. And she literally said, she didn't share details, but like she said, she had been sexually assaulted and raped.
Mm.
And then she looked at me and made incredibly sweet eye contact. She said, you're the only man I've told this to.
Hmm.
But she hadn't even told that to her husband.
Wow.
And which was like, okay, that's quite a leap.
Hmm.
Said the only person I've told that to is my therapist. And so we talked a little bit more and totally supported her in that. And one of the pieces that she had made a commitment to herself with was it, and I wasn't her therapist. I didn't become her therapist. I mean, we didn't do any of that kind of, I mean, we talked just like I was talking to everybody else.
Right.
And but when she left, she gave me a hug and she said, I'm going to share this with my husband.
Oh, good.
And it was like, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm. And my comment to her, because she had talked about her husband in a very kind way. And I said, I'll bet with what you've told me about him that you'll be able to go through a hard time and come out okay. And she goes, yep, we can do that. And so I haven't heard anything from her.
Yeah.
The workshop just ended Saturday, so.
Yeah.
But that's what we need to do. It's a relational connection that we need to make.
Mm.
And because we can go through a hard time in contact and relationship with anybody. And it's part of why I do the work I do with horses is because if we can't do that with a person, many times we can do it with a horse. And we can get that, some of that foundation that we can then take and go do that with another
human
being that happens to be a human this time.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I need you on for a second episode to just go through the horse therapy.
Okay.
Aspect.
I'd love to do that.
Because
let's do that.
Love horses. Okay. So for those that are listening that want to find you, where can they find you and get more information about your attachment theory and the work you do?
I'm on Instagram and Facebook under Dewey Freeman.
And I'll tag all those.
Yeah. My website is DeweyFreeman.org. Also, there's a website for the Gestalt Equine Institute of the Rockies, which is just Gestalt Equine Institute. On there, you'll also find connections to Kimberly. Mm-hmm. Kimberly runs the Colorado Ecotherapy Institute. And so I'm on her stuff and she's on my stuff. Yeah. So, but those are really the places to find
me. Okay, perfect. Dewey, thank you so much for being here with me.
This was delightful.
Aww.
And thank you so much.
I was just going to say that I think I did better with not, I get so excited and then my Southern drawl comes out even more. And I think that I think I held it in.
Well, I was able to understand every word.
Not everything had 3 and 4 syllables. So it's great. I think it went
great. So, and I would, you had mentioned at one point before, can you come out here and do some different classes? We do a bunch of different classes. We, both Kimberly and I do, the class that you might be interested in and other people might be really interested in. It's my developmental model, that is integrated with Wilhelm Reich's body structures and breathwork and his body structures. That's a really fun class for people. People don't have to be a therapist to come to that or a coach. And there are numbers of other classes, but that's one that if someone really wants to do a bit of a deeper dive into this, that'd be a really good class. Right now, someone will probably listen to this and go on the website and say, where is it? We had a date and we lost our place to do it, so we have to come up with another place. So.
Okay.
But that's back, that's in the works.
Okay. Yeah, I definitely want to do that. Absolutely. 1,000%.
Yeah, that'd be really fun.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being here. And I'm going to tag all your information so everybody can find you. And happy early birthday for next month.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, it's not that far away.
It's not. Oh, we're in June now. And
I know.
Leo the Lion gets to celebrate. It's exciting.
So, and I might have to go up and look what an Enneagram 5 is.
Okay. Yeah. No, I'm going to send you a link. I'm going to text you a link for a test to take. And for everybody listening, I can put it in the notes too, but it's truity.com has an Enneagram, free Enneagram test, and they give you your top, what they think your top one is. But I always recommend it, read whatever your top two are so that you can see which one resonates.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds good. I may consult you about it.
Okay. I love it. All right. Thank you for being here. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you guys next time.
Thank you so very much.